you know, part of the glory of the medium is that two creative minds meshing together.
Well, then you have something that's talked about a lot in what I've been reading about these, which is the editor. What does the editor do?
Well, what any editor does, the editor will say, you know, this scene is kind of talky. You know, you might, so the way I'm talking about Alan Moore does it, which is more or less the way I do it, too, you write your script and you give it to the editor before the artist does it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the editor will look it over and he'll say, okay, well, you know, this kind of doesn't work, it doesn't work, you need to touch this up. So you touch it up, and then it goes to the artist, and the artist, you know, does what's called pencils, maybe even what's called just breakdowns, very rough sketches of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So like storyboards in a movie, you know?
Right.
The editor looks at that and looks at, you know, what needs to be more, says, like, you know, okay, well, this panel here is really confused, can't figure out what's going on. You need a segue between this and that. You know, what editors do. And then the artist adapts it, and then, you know, same with, you know, goes back and forth until you have something that everybody feels is pretty good. That's in the best instance, because sometimes you don't have enough time to do it right.
How long does it take to create a book?
Okay, you know, I mean, like, Prometheus was famously late all the time. They would promise it, like, you know, in 6 weeks it wouldn't be out for, like, 3 months. You know, partly because they were doing other things, but also because, you know, if you look at it, you can see how much incredible detail is in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, J.H. Williams III and Mick Gray, the, you know, the pencil and the inker, you know, they had tremendous amounts of work to do. And so they, you know, so it was often late for that reason, and more scripts were so long, so you'd be late sending them a script. But, you know, ideally, in a comic book, it's once a month. It comes out in a month, you know. So you have to be able to turn them out.
Yeah, it's, it is. You can really tell that these things are complicated here.
Yeah.
So, let's get started. By the way, we are being recorded, so I wanted to let you know.
I turned it on late, so I'm sorry. Not all of Rachel's commentary
okay.
got on it, but that's okay.
But,
I mean,
you know, but these are just, so if you miss a class and you want to, or one of these things, you can, I don't particularly think of these things as classes, but if you miss one of these things, you can catch up if you want to. All right, so everybody got a part? And,
no, not yet.
All right, who doesn't have a part?
Sal doesn't have a part.
And Sal doesn't have a part. But that's okay. Let me lurk. I may have to mute myself also because I'm coughing.
Well,
in the
we wanted you to be Sophie.
You did.
Sophie last week. Did you want to be Sophie again?
No, I think I was Sophie just the first time.
Sal, why don't you be Sophie's mother, Trish?
Okay.
That's a short one. And let's see. You could also be...
Margaret, the doctor.
Margaret, yeah, I didn't get her. Margie we've got, but we don't have a...
Anna, whatever her name is.
We do need an Anna, too. That's also a relatively brief
role. Yeah. Who's
doing Stasia?
I want to do Stasia. That's okay. If you want to do it, go ahead.
No.
Okay. And since you're doing texture, why don't you do the start us off with place and location, which is how we start this thing after the title.
Okay, so can we like the title page kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why not?
I just mean the top of the page. Okay. I'm often saying Promethea, being an epic on the realms of fantasy, in the words of Charlton Sennett, privately imprinted in the city of Boston, entitled A Fairy Romance. South Tower Hospital, New York, 1999 AD.
I don't understand this. Why is her body rejecting the graft clone tissue? It should be exactly the same as her own. I'm going to have to give her antibiotics to check her rejection process. that's going to be a boost the risk of infection. We don't have a choice. If her body continues to reject itself, Mrs. Shelley is dead.
Well, I gotta say, this don't look too friggin' good.
But I look at it, don't you, there was the funny black infection in the wound when she was brought in.
In fact, this looks friggin' awful. I wonder what the girls have to say about it.
Yes, but the infection vanished. I mean, it didn't clear up, but it just, I don't know, evaporated or something, like it was never there.
Maybe I ought to go ask them. I haven't been across to visit in a while, but I still guess I still know the way.
Barbara, we were wondering when you'd show up. Do close the door. You're letting in a dreadful smell in that cemetery.
Sorry. Hi, Grace. Hi, Margaret. Anna, Bill. Hi, Margie. Boy, I'll tell you, I've had a rough night. Like, first there's this little teenage Promethea, then I get in a slapping match with a shmee, and now I think I'm dying.
Poor darling. That harebell and meadowsweet picks you a drink and it tells all about it. What's a new girl like? Flat-chested and neurotic, I'll bet.
Oh, well, yeah, pretty much. But I'll tell you, Grace, she's good when she gets into character. She's just about vaporized that shmee. Thanks, girls. That's plenty.
Okay, this is one of the other...
Barbara, honey. Grace was just being catty. We're sure she's fabulous.
And who's Margaret?
Will somebody jump in and take it?
I'll do it. Bill, you think everything's fabulous. So, Barbara, does this new vessel have a name?
Yeah, her name's Sophie Bangs, and she's a college kid.
I'm not sorry.
The wrong person.
Wrong person.
Oh, okay.
That's Barbara.
Yeah, her name's Sophie Bangs, and she's a college kid. I'm just worried I'm gonna croak before I've shown her the ropes. Say, this is pretty good. What is it?
It's a liqueur made from moonlight and cream of communion. Anna imagined it into existence the other day, didn't you, darling? Oh, it's Anna.
That well, I did, Grace. All right, go on.
That I did, Mrs. Grace. Mr. West sounds to be as young as I. We should look in the star pole and see how she fares.
Oh, you are being nosy. This is a fine thing I do not think of.
Shut up, Margie. Can you see anything, Anna?
Mayhap I can, Mistress Bill. Is that the girl you spoke of, Mistress Barbara?
Yeah, that's her. Last night she handled one shmee, two Gotaic demons, and a rescue from the Materia. Guess she's sleeping it off.
Only two Gotaic demons, darling? That's nothing.
Shush, Grace. Let's see what she does.
God, you are totally an enormous lesbo. Yeah, we have Sophie here.
Yeah, who's Sophie?
We need Sophie.
That was Cynthia.
And we also need Trish, who's in the bathrobe there.
Yeah, I'll be Trish.
So we have the mom
speaking.
Oh, okay. About an hour before you did.
Hello? This is this kind of page. You read across the two pages, not one page at a time.
Yeah.
So the first dialogue is...
you wish.
Yeah,
you wish. Stasia, my head's full of pop rocks. Do you remember what happened last night?
Yeah, you're Propelia. Holy cow, Sophie.
Promethea, but yeah, you're right. Holy cow. You know, when I woke up, I was still holding the ballpoint. The one Mrs. Shelley gave me? Come on, let's go to breakfast.
Oh, morning, Soph. Oh, and your little pal. What did you two get in last night?
About an hour before you did. Are both those coffees for you?
Morning, Trish. You look great.
Drop dead, you little moron, and Sophie, my coffee's none of your business, okay? Hey, Trixie, where's that coffee? It's Trish, and I got it here, you jerk. Jesus Christ.
You know, Soph, your mom is a vast whore. I don't admire her.
Yeah, whatever. This Promethea business is scaring me, Stace. I have to find out more about it.
That'll make things more, I don't know, more real. We don't just forget anything happened.
There are real people trying to kill me, Stacia. Others before have copped with this thing. I gotta be like them.
What, you mean dead?
I'm serious. We'll finish our cereal, then we'll go to the library. I can maybe find out more material on Charlton Senate and those guys. Now, eat your chocolates, Pops.
Crack chocolates, Pops. Now we have a bunch of dialogues from people who've not attributed to anybody, so we have to just guess who's speaking.
Okay. All right, well, let's see. I'll do it then.
Okay.
I had forgot just what a whirl and a dazzle there is in the mortal world. And I like the way these girls are. They seem not so cowed by things as I once was. Anna, darling. Back in your day, you'd be beaten if you answered these scatty little bits of fluff have had their life rather easier.
And then this is Margie. Oh, they are rude, that is for sure. Oh, yes.
Margie, why don't you just shut up your little hole? I think Sophie is very sweet. She's... Oh, look, this smartass is going to get donuts. That must have been Stacy.
Yeah. And then one of the Prometheus said, okay, it got on my nerves. Yeah,
I think that was Stacia, the one Sophie rescued from Inventuria. See how Sophie heads straight for the library, check things out?
Barbara, I think that's you. I told you
she was smart.
I told you she was smart.
Yeah.
Next one is Margaret Lefinger.
Yeah, Margaret.
She needs to be more than smart, Barbara. We've notched up a great enemies over the centuries. They'll all be gunning for her during the first few weeks, during her transition period, when she's at her most inexperienced. It's another one of the Prometheus.
Yeah, that's Barbara. Margaret. Yeah. World War One person. With the helmet.
Who's Margaret?
Yeah, she's like a baby crab. Fresh hatched upon the tideline, she has to run for the safety of the ocean before the gulls take her. And now, Barbara?
Yes, the temple already tried twice. I wonder who will be next. I mean, I thought maybe the Night Queen. She always gave you and me a hard time, Bill.
Oh, I'll say that's a sulfurous slut got me killed, you know. Still, I hear her hardly leave the underworld these days.
I do not like bad fairies, no sir.
Huh. Margie, darling, much as I love you, if you don't keep quiet, I shall disintegrate you. Oh, look, yeah. It's your story the new girl's interested in.
I so it seems. I cannot say I like it when my tail is red. The pain of it is all too fresh. My baby and how she was took from me and him, I loved him. Just as that I did. I loved him.
Are we reading?
Chapter 1.
Yeah. Okay.
Charles Sennett was 28 years old when he took his adoring wife, Emily, and moved to her to the Woodside cabin on the outskirts of Boston in April 1779. Sennett, the son of a New Hampshire mill owner, Emily 2 years before. He had been 26, and she, girl of barely 20, at that time was a young man without profession who subsisted on a generous allowance from his wealthy father. Though it seems he had discussed the possibility of taking some pursuit upon the occasion, and it was not until the spring that he and his wife settled in there.
I am alone. I stare into the table's wood grain and dare not look up. I say the words once more. I am alone. My wife has gone, my Emily. So too has Anna gone, my mistress, and with her my muse, likewise departed. I shall say it again. I am alone. Today is a new year, first day of a bright new century. I fear I am not long for. More than 20 years ago, we came here when this place seemed full of hope. Hope and inspiration.
Master Charlton? Mistress Emily says I'm to call you for your supper. Beg your pardon, sir, for interrupting.
Oh, don't worry, Anna. You're not interrupting anything of consequence. I'm 50 stanzas into this confounded piece, and nothing interesting has happened.
Oh, do not say such things, sir. What you read to me about this shepherd boy fair tugged my heart.
Why, bless you. Sadly, I'm having rather more difficulty imagining the fairies my poem's supposedly about.
Ah, Charleston, there you are. What a feast I've made for us. You're surely hungry after your hard work.
I'll go and see the gravy doesn't burn.
Emily, it may not look as if I'm doing much, but writing is hard work.
I'm certain that it is, but surely one as practiced as yourself might do it with his eyes closed. In fact, now I think if I'm of it, I'm sure I've often seen you work that way. Anna, dear, you pass the gravy.
Then to that diamond-beaded glade there came a pageant throng of sweet imaginings, of fairies, imps, and creatures without name, a great frenetic bustling of wings. About their queen, four nymphs in waiting stood, girded in armor, each of beauty rare, cowslip and flax and jenny in the wood, and sweet Promethea with her plaited hair.
One of the Prometheus.
Good day to you, Master Charlton.
Uh-huh. Anna? June 7th, 1779.
This is Anna.
Oh. Well, Master Charlton, with Miss Emily away to see your parents in New Hampshire this next week, perhaps you'll get some work done.
Actually, Anna, I've already made great progress, and it's thanks to you.
To me? Why, sir, whatever do you mean?
Well, I've partly based the leading fairy upon you after this sort of daydream that I had. Here, if you like, I'll read some to you. Promethea, the shepherd understood, had with her glamours captivated him, with lips, with skin like polished betel wood, with ocean eyes wherein a man might swim. Her smile ethereal, magnificent, her lyric movements, her fragility, her gentleness, her orchidaceous scent enraptured him, enslaved him utterly. Phantasmagoria made somehow real, yet delicate, perhaps to disappear at his impetuous touch, his need to feel her summer jasmine breath close to his ear.
Charlton, more words. Words, bring me through.
Unchained, the poet shepherd's tongue took flight. Such verse and poesy from his lips there poured. Anna? Is it you? As might lend substance to this sylph of light, or goad the very heavens to applaud.
No.
She, raised in realms of fancy, had ne'er known another's flesh, nor that warm mortal thrill of passion. How they loved, each sigh and moan would halt the world, orbid all time stand still. Each kiss endured while mountains wore to dust, whole lives passed twixt each measured bedboard creek. So lost were they in their transcendent lust that they knew not the hour, nor day, nor week. Embracing heaven, earth slips through our hands. Worldly affairs fragment and fall away. We reach that place which no man understands, where reason falters and blind love holds sway.
Master Chaplin, was it ever, was it ever me you loved? Just for a little while?
Hush, Anna, the baby.
The baby's wrong. You can't make children with a story. Did you love me?
Anna?
Did you?
Anna, it's coming. Oh, dear Lord. The baby is... Oh, God. Anna, the baby, it's not a baby. It's only half real, Anna. It's... Anna? I only made one grave, which some found queer, but there was only Anna to be buried. After all, we did not have a child. Rather, we had the dream of one. And that dream, why, it vanished, melted quite away. Save for these wretched, ill-kept journals, I have written not a word since then. My muse is gone. I see the fairies only when I drink now, which is all the time. My love is not amongst them. It was not Anna that I loved. It was the fantasy I'd spun about her. Now that fantasy had fled, I sometimes doubt it ever truly happened, and was not instead some dream of mine. But things are ever thus with fairies and romance. I am alone.
Sophie?
Huh?
Sophie?
I guess she goes, huh? Wait a minute. What's happening here?
Oh, no, you go down the page, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. She's at her desk. How did it get so dark? Where did everybody go?
How did it get so dark?
Who?
Where did everybody go?
Who?
Either phrase would work nicely on a tombstone, wouldn't it?
Wait a minute. What's happening here? Who are you?
Did you ever see a dream walking? Well, I did. Did you ever hear a dream talking? Well, I did. You're Sophie Banks, isn't it? You're the new beauteous cutiest with a caduceus up your gluteus. I'm Jack.
I don't know what you're talking about. Wait a minute. I heard of you. Bar? A friend of mine. I think she mentioned you.
Bat Babs? Complimentary, I hope. She's going to die, you know, in 3 days' time.
Look, I don't know what's going on, okay? And I don't know who you think you are, where I am, but this is creepy, and I'm getting out of here.
Oh, Sophie.
That's the name game.
Oh, yeah, Sophie. Bye, Sophie. Banana, Fana. Oh, for me. Me, Mo. Sophie. Sophie.
Let's cut the crap.
He says that.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Jack says this. Let's cut the crap.
Okay.
Ooh.
Okay. This is Margaret?
This is
Promethea. Cynthia.
Yeah, Promethea.
Yeah.
Oh, you want me to continue with Prometheus or with Sophie?
No,
they're both.
Both.
They're the same.
All right. You've revealed me. Clearly, you have much art. I think you knew, I know, you from before. You are the magician,
the snake handler, the juggler. You introduced yourself to me when I was Bill, and then when I was Barbara.
Yes.
I think that Jack speaks across the way, but then we go down each page separately after Jack speaks up there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, so it's up here. You do know how many enemies you're gunning for here, don't you? There's a magician called Benny Solomon. I hear he's flying into New York especially to see you. You ought to watch out for him. He sent those demons.
Yes, so they told me.
Oh, well, there it goes back to the previous page.
Actually, that seems to follow.
Okay, it doesn't make sense. I'm sorry, maybe I'm wrong there. It was Barbara. Yeah, so I was my mistake. So the Jack dialogue should have followed after.
I'll go down then. Okay. You know why. Always like that when you're at this stage, when you've not yet clearly defined who you are. I thought I'd come and introduce myself to the new girl before she's had time to become prejudiced against me.
You thought you'd see how big a threat Sophie poses before she's experienced enough to spot you coming? I take that your youthful appearance is merely a glamour you molded for the occasion?
Allow an old man his vanities. After all, she is a very attractive young woman. And I'm Jack the Faust. I like to look my best. I like to keep up appearances.
Were you hoping to... Were you hoping to seduce her?
Oh, please, give me some credit. I have something to buy for that. To be honest, I just wanted to see her before she ends up insane or gutted on an altar somewhere. I mean, you do know that she has many enemies are gunning for her, don't you? There's a magician called Benny Solomon, I hear. He's flying into New York especially to see you ought to watch out for him. He's sent those demons.
Yeah, so they told me. He works for the temple.
Only on a freelance basis. The temple would never admit to employing a magician. It's against their religion. Still, they want you dead, and they think you're going to end the world.
Why would they think that?
Oh, you're so sweet when you're in this amnesic between states. I almost forget how much I hate you the rest of the time. They think that because you are going to end the world, dummy.
But that's not true.
You really can't remember anything, can you? Now, personally, I think ending the world is an excellent idea. Any real magician would agree. Prometheus' father certainly did when he unleashed his dying curse upon humanity. That's you, incidentally.
That's Jack Fast.
Jack.
I see I have your attention.
Then
Barbara.
Jack Faust, goddamn. This is screwed. Bill, you or me should have spotted him earlier. The amount of trouble he gave us.
Well, don't look at me. You can see yourself he was using glamour. I never had any resistance to glamour.
Don't keep us in suspense, darling. Who is he?
Jack's a magician, or at least he is these days. He's manipulating Sophie, misdirecting her. You heard what he said about ending the world.
Oh, he is that, yes.
Be quiet, Grace. Margie, this is serious. Too much knowledge might unbalance her.
Yes, it might rather. An insane Prometheus is too dreadful to contemplate. You know, I absolutely hate magicians.
It's more.
Margaret.
What are you going to do? He sneered her. Her father was vulnerable.
And then Anna.
Sisters, look here. A new image is forming. Oh, it's a little Miss. I guess this is.
It's probably Grace, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, it's little Miss. My head's so wide, I need indicator lights on my glasses. What's she doing?
She has donuts. I am hungry for sure.
Will somebody shut this little pigment up before I club her?
She is such an annoying little brat.
Yeah. Oh, I'll be Sophie. I mean, Stacia. Wow, tons of stuff. I gotta print some of this.
For set's sake.
What? What did you do? What happened to the other guy? Oh, no, that's right. That was Sophie saying that.
That's so funny.
He was a glamour, you vacuous little bimbo. And this whole thing was a waste of my time. I hope Benny Solomon's boys cut you to pieces.
Hey, you leave her be.
Up yours, Gidget. And as for you, you're going to get exactly what you deserve. I could have had things real sweet in the beanstalk kingdom if you hadn't bitched everything up. Screw you, lady. Screw you.
Well, he thought, God, when I walked in, he was like totally having sex with you.
He was not. He was just touching my hand. It was some kind of mind thing he was doing. He said a lot of stuff, and it was all sort of scary and upsetting. Everything was dark, like the library was deserted.
Aw, you were just a maniac wino. Hey, look what I got. There's all kinds of stuff about Prometheus I found on the net. There's this French lesbian writer, there's this thing, the Book of Prometheus, and there's this black metal band called Hecatean Throne.
Jasia.
No, but, like, they have this number called Promethea, My Darkest Mask of Surreality.
Stace, I just read this really sad story about the 18th century Promethea, and then that magician guy jumped me. I'm kind of shook up, Prometheaed out. Can't we just go into college and do something normal?
Going to college is normal? This is texture. Made of Sunny Baskerville? Nuts of a lot. The Sleep Inquiry, New York's first multiple personality disorder mayor, becomes more complex today. A new personality called the Squealer claimed that all 42 personalities, including himself, were elaborate sham. This is texture.
Great.
Well, she seems to have survived.
Well, yes, it was a lucky break, though. Her friend coming back like that.
Yeah, and Jack was only messing with her. Anyone else would have just shot her. She's helpless, without guidance. Faust was right. Benny Solomon's friends from the Howling will pulverize her. God, how many lives did Promethea's dad screw up?
Barbara, honey, you're just upset. Promethea's existence is necessary.
Right. Is that what you told yourself when poor crazy Dennis Strucker blew your head off? In case
it escaped the view.
In case it's escaped the attention of you ladies, I'm the only person here that's been being Promethea hasn't killed. Then back in the hospital. Damn.
Next to no man's land.
You know, as I'm rereading this stuff with you guys, I didn't see it last night, but off and on, Nicholas and I watch Lost. Does anybody else follow Lost?
Lost?
Not anymore.
Not anymore, but you're familiar with it?
Yes, I am familiar with it.
Do you get a sense of Promethea and her multiple characters as being Jacob on Lost? It's a very complex kind of surreal story where these people crash on an island and they have a parallel life going on in their own countries. They come from all over the world, mostly Australia and parts of the States, but other places as well. And there's an experiment going on. It's kind of like almost a graphic novel in and of itself, but it's based either on an afterlife, a parallel afterlife, or a parallel universe concept. And in a way, the land of that Promethea comes out of, and Alan Moore's way of handling it, and the way he handles, I think, the Tree of Life, sort of are those parallel universes, only he calls it immateria.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That's very interesting. I never would have thought to put that together, but now that you mention it, it kind of makes sense. Yeah.
If you can rent like the seasons, it goes on forever, but I think this is the last year.
And you know what, though? In the very beginning, in the first season or two, I don't think there was any of that in there. I think it was strictly a desert island kind of survival kind of story.
Absolutely.
And then it kind of evolved. Yeah.
Yes, it totally evolved.
They had to something to explain why the heavyset guy never lost any weight. The women had always perfectly clean bodies. They didn't need to shave or pluck their mustaches.
And they still worked just fine. You know,
The material, we don't have to shave our legs.
Or underarms. I mean, they're so perfectly groomed, it's ridiculous.
Right.
The only thing that may be a little messy is their hair, you know? But where do they get the makeup from?
Perfect sweat marks.
Yeah.
Like they have special t-shirts with perfectly V sweat marks.
Yes.
And yet nothing under their arms. Obviously, their underarm deodorant floated onto the island with them.
Totally. Perpetual deodorant.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, I think one of the things you're demonstrating, Cynthia, by remarks, unfortunately, I was never able to get into Lost, which is probably good because I probably would have been very frustrated with it a couple of years.
Oh, yeah, it's very frustrating, trust me.
And the, but it's the issue about all stories there that there are only one or two stories in the world.
Mm.
You know, that there's only, you know, there's only, I think one Freudian once said there's only two stories in the world, Oedipus and Hamlet.
If you look at it from each distinct point of view of each of the characters in those, there you have. You're probably right. Harry was probably right.
I think Oedipus, Hamlet, and Romeo and Juliet. You have to have unrequited love.
There's
unrequited love in Hamlet.
That's his mother.
I think they have innumerable. I think Freud was rather limited in his point of view, but in terms of plot and storylines, I think the number 32 comes to me. I don't think there's been much more than that.
You know, I've often thought about doing a dartboard, you know, with each of those, 20 to 30 storylines, and say, okay, my next story will be, bing, you know, and there
it is. There are popular, I've seen popular accounts, I can't think, pop to mind right now, that have been out over the years that say, you know, here are the four quintessential plot lines of which all other things are derivative, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You say comedy and tragedy. You know, you die at the end or you live at the end.
Which one is comedy and which one is tragedy?
depends who you are.
I don't know. Sometimes living at the end is pretty tragic, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, so.
I need to get off for just a minute. I'll be back. Don't say anything bad about me while I'm gone.
All right. One of the issues that comes up for me in this story, or the variants of this story in this chapter, has to do with the imposition of fantasy on the other. This is what Charlton did to Anna. you know. I mean, this is a sort of an exaggeration of something that we're all guilty of in varying degrees, which is what we call projection.
It's also the seduction of the imagination.
Yes.
The seduction of the imagination and of getting involved in a fantasy life.
Yeah, but in some ways we're talking about projection, but here we're talking about projection sort of amped. You know, this is projection on amphetamine or something.
You know, actually I think one of the main points of this chapter was the concept of a muse.
I think that the muse is definitely a way of also approaching the stuff that I wanted that I'm reminded of. How do you see the muse work go there?
Well, you know, according to a legend, mythology, I think there are 9 muses, all coming from, is it Mnemosyne?
Mnemosyne, yeah.
Yes. So,
Which is the goddess of memory.
Memory.
Right. And then we have the muses. I guess we could update their titles. But, you know, laughter, mirth, pretty much tragedy. I think there was philosophy. But in a sense, you know, it was more of a Platonic kind of listing of muses. Today, I think we would name them.
They're for the art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially the
arts.
So
the arts, the music, and epic poetry,
usually it's the muse is the creative inspiration or the motivation.
Yes, and for most it's a person, living or dead, who and of the opposite sex. It's sort of like your anima or your animus. I think you could brought that to that. You know, correct me, anyone.
That's a modern version of it, though. You know,
yes, it's a modern version that I'm addressing.
Were goddesses.
Yes.
And that they actually, you know, spoke the poem. So, like, you know, singing the muse of the Wrath of Achilles, the famous opening of the Iliad, is like, you know, Homer is saying, well, I'm the singer, but it's really the muse who's making the poem.
Right.
But when we stop believing in the gods, so in the modern time, what we end up with is, as you say, a person that inspires us. We call that person our muse. I don't think that was the ancient concept.
No, it was not. It definitely was not.
Yeah.
But it definitely was not.
But what I'm heading towards is that if 10 in our suits, our 4 suits, of the minor arcana is sort of an overshot, so to speak, heading back towards the ace. And we have numerologically numbers 1 through 9 in the Pythagorean system, and there are 9 muses plus mnemosyne, memory, which might be your ace or your 10. We could think of the 4 suits as being 4 aspects of muses. Of the 10 muses, including mnemosyne. So, you know, I don't know. How does that ring with anyone?
Well, I think that if we look at the muses as a personification of the imagination, functioning at different levels.
Exactly.
And of course, mnemosyne is you know, that... There is no functional imagination without memory. If you have no memory, it's very hard to have an active imagination. That's
memory is a very interesting point, because as Rachel said, Homer said of the Iliad, you know, my muse, the muse is really telling the poem, and I am just the channel for this. That is also the literary, how would you say, trope of Blavatsky, of many people in metaphysics and theosophy.
But it's more than a trope. There are people who write at a level to where they feel they're taking dictation.
Mm. Totally true. Well, any artist would tell you that's true, and whether it be in writing or painting
or whatever. Philip K. Dick said he was channeling everything.
He even said,
definitely went crazy.
Yeah, and he definitely went crazy, is right. I mean, if you're open to the muse...
The first page you channeled was, the Valis text. He didn't
have
those novels.
And it was a beautiful piece of work.
So in the last
novels were in balance between, imagination and obsession.
Yeah, I for the last couple of years, I've been interviewing authors for this radio show, once a week at least. I've talked to dozens and dozens of authors of various skill levels. Almost every one of them talks about how they are taken over for a while by their characters, that they obsess over their characters, and their characters sometimes become autonomous and say to them, I won't do that, or they insist that they speak and that they write in their voice. They become the voice of it. They want to take over.
That happens with actors also.
Yeah. But the thing is people are saying that, Paul, but it's a simplified way of expressing it. They're still conscious. They still know what they're doing.
This is true.
Apparently, it's a different thing entirely. Being an artist is that there's a double thing going on. The character is speaking, but you're still the writer shaping it.
You still have your own name, and you still can shave in the morning.
And also, you're still in control of the words that go on the page. You're just letting the sense of the character. It's a kind of complicated thing. It's not as simple as saying the character is, a person.
I agree that there are degrees of this, and that there are probably degrees of it which are psychosis, and there are lots of degrees before psychosis that are creative and varying degrees of conscious and unconscious.
It's a thin line, though, between the two. It really is.
Maybe.
I don't know. I really think, when you look around this world, tell me that this is the same world. This isn't the world. So let's just put everything in proportion. But while this conversation is extremely interesting, and I didn't mean to veer off. What I'm trying to say is, do you think it's possible to look at the four suits of the minor arcana in terms of each card being a muse?
We would have to really analyze that. Very deeply. That's a separate class unto itself.
Yeah, it is. It's something I've been thinking about very seriously.
If you go to the identification of the classic muses by ancient Greek mythology.
No, I wouldn't be doing that. I would be working with them, but around them.
So, Cynthia, since there are four suits, what if you're not in each suit? Would they be four different sets of muses or four aspects of each muse?
Yeah.
Four aspects of each muse.
So, like the two in every suit is the same muse.
Yeah.
But seen a different idea. So it's like, the sort of fiery version of that particular muse and the watery version. That's a very interesting idea.
We have a Janus head, which is two-faced.
Right.
We don't have a four-faced. We need a nice term for four-faced people.
Quadrupeds.
Mayan god that's four-faced.
Shiva is also portrayed, and also some of the goddess images are portrayed with four faces.
Okay.
And we have...
Right. That's right. The Heindel Tarot by Hermann Heindel, drama with the Two of Wands is four faces. And they merge into each other, which is kind of nice.
Mm.
Well, the World card is basically as the four aspects.
I was thinking of the world card and
the cherubim.
Supposed
to have four faces.
Well,
this does go back to the stuff I mentioned, I think, with Douglas Fawcett and his world as imagination.
Yes, I got that book. I haven't looked at it yet, though. I just got it.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I actually did.
You actually were able to find it somewhere?
Yeah, I found it used, and I can't remember now where I got it. I just did an internet search, and I was
That's incredible, because I've been looking for that book for years.
Yeah, yeah, and it wasn't even that terribly expensive. I was kind of...
Well, he's represents a minor stream of English idealism. It was based on German idealism. Douglas Fawcett. He wrote his last works that he wrote was called the Zermatt Dialogues, and he lived in was one of the editors of Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. He was sort of a young undergraduate. He didn't have that much to do with it at the time. And then got his degree, eventually lived on a comfortable allowance in Switzerland, where his last writings came out just before World War II, which was, he never held much of an academic post, so he had no influence in the academy. There's a summary of his imagism in later British Philosophy, which is a two-volume work that came out in the 1920s. There's an essay about him. And he influenced an American metaphysician named Weatherhead or something like that, who wrote an essay about his work. But it's one of the few secondary works about him at all. But the whole issue with him is, I tried to get interested in this. This is years ago, back in the 70s. Was what's his name? Hillman, James Hillman.
Oh yeah, sure.
And James Hillman did a lot to revive what that called this autonomous imagination issue.
Well, actually, I'm going to make a correction to that. In my opinion, and in the opinion of many others, Ira Progoff preceded James Hillman quite a bit in that regard.
Well, yeah, he's older.
I'm not being sarcastic. I'm saying that James Hillman lifted quite a bit from Ira Progoff.
Well, be that as it may, I wish that when they were when he was popularizing his archetypal psychology orientation on Jung, he'd pay a little more attention to Fawcett, who is otherwise waned in utter obscurity, probably for good reasons, there's a couple of reasons why he probably deserves to stay in obscurity.
Well, I'm looking through this book right now, and I mean, it is dense.
That's the big fat one, right?
Yeah, it is the big fat one.
Yeah,
the World is Imagination. It actually says Douglas Fawcett Edward. I don't know if was, a name he didn't use or what, but...
Another writer who explores imagination in great detail is Kathleen Raine, R-A-I-N-E. She's the gal who wrote Yeats and the Tarot. She was a wonderful poet.
William Blake stuff.
William Blake. She's a William Blake scholar, a Yeatsian scholar. And she was a wonderful poet in her own right, and wrote a great deal on Thomas Taylor as well, and totally into the Neoplatonics. Now, her contribution really comes from, I think, Henry Corbin.
Her influence was Coleridge.
Coleridge?
Coleridge, yeah.
I think you may be mixing her up with Northrop Frye in that regard, but in my...
Well, I'm going by her autobiography.
Yeah, no, I've read it also. I adore her.
Mm.
One of the things about her is her term imaginal, which I believe comes from Henry Corbin, and she uses it quite a bit, and of course, we're using the word immateria here. I'm just interested in the way people express that alternate state, that creative state, that world of imagination, their garden of imagination, if you will.
Well, I do agree that Henry Corbin's trilogy, which is it's a three-volume work. Although they can easily be read independent of one another. It starts with Ibn Sina and the Visionary Recital.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, there is it's got another. It's going by another title now, but it's it used to be called The Creative Imagination and the Sufism of Ibn Arabi.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third volume is Spiritual Body, Celestial Earth, and which gets very deeply into the Persian use of Herqalia, which is the city of the imagination. And that was, I think a couple of years ago, I was telling you I had a dream in which I was going to Herqalia on a boat.
Well, there you go. Did you ever get there?
Yeah. I don't know if I ever left. That's the problem. Speaking of psychosis,
can I get back to talk about fairies, though, and our sylphs, as we say in the magical realm?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There is a great documentary movie about people who've actually experienced the gnomes, the fairies, and the elementals. And I believe it's called In Search of Fairies. It's a British film.
Is
it a documentary?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Taking accounts.
Evan Wentz, the famous guy who brought
to
the West, his dissertation in Oxford was In Search of Fairies.
Sorry, who did you say, Paul?
Evan Wentz.
Oh, okay.
He's a fairy tale scholar too.
He started out. His dissertation was on In Search of the Fairies, and he what he wanted to do is he went around and talked to a bunch of peasants, in England and Ireland, and got their stories about the fairy folk. I've actually had experience with. I used to go spend a lot of time out in the woods, mountain climbing and stuff like that. Not any technical stuff, but just climbing up in the hills. And I saw enough astral strange entities and fairy folk running around there that I have a good sense of what people mean when they say that they're whisked off by fairy.
Yep.
And what that might mean magically or imaginatively.
Yeah.
And this, even though we might be running far afield with our references here, this stuff still does get based on, the way each of us uses our imagination, both as tarot readers and as and just as negotiating the world of meaning and play.
It's so funny. I will tell you this. My husband, Stuart, is plagued by gnome stealing.
Oh, really?
Oh. It is like they want... They steal from him like crazy. And I have to find it. I'm the only one who could find the stuff. He was there doing some repairs in the backyard. I saw what he was doing. I knew what he was doing. I was right over him, giving him a hand. He says, I just placed down this... this bit, screwdriver bit,
Uh-huh.
I placed it down right here. He didn't move nothing. I knew where it was. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was clear across the over-tilled earth. I'm going over. I found it. I said, and I'm screaming, give it back. Come on, give it back. People must have gone crazy. I'm outside. Listen, cut the bullshit here. I'm in my Brooklynese. Stop driving him crazy. And sure enough, I found it. All of a sudden, it miraculously reappeared across the other way of the planting bed.
You sure you don't have a poltergeist?
I was thinking the same thing.
No, it's the gnomes. They pull his chain every so often.
They yank his chain.
Yeah, they yank his chain, and I'm there because he's Mr. Stoic and everything like that. And they go, "Hey, you're living in a magical house. We're here."
this actually reminds us. So we have some time to deal with it. This would be the time to do our oracle, a question of our oracle.
Yep.
Does anyone have a question that they want to raise relevant to our reading or our discussion, and that we can then do, I guess we should probably still do that.
Paul, I have a question.
Yeah.
Not sure how to phrase it, but something like, what is our relationship to the immateria?
Okay.
As a group?
Well, as human beings.
In general, huh?
As human beings.
Ah, okay.
So what is, how do we connect to the immateria? What does it mean to us? No.
Okay, I'm shuffling. I got the Toph deck out. So the question is, what is our relationship to the immateria?
Yeah.
Maybe, do you want to know how to access it?
What is the immateria?
What is the immateria?
What is the immateria, and then what is our relationship to it?
Okay. So, I'm going... should we do multiples or just one?
Just one. It makes more sense.
Yeah.
And it's clear.
Okay.
What is the immateria?
If anyone else is doing it, maybe they do it for themselves. Yeah, maybe they just do it for themselves. I'll do the general, and because I hear other people shuffling, so we don't get confused here. We, you know, I'll do it for the group.
One bit of magic that's already come out of this discussion for me is I have a whole new respect for the Toph deck. I never liked Toph much.
Mm-hmm.
I found it very dense, very, it didn't speak to me. And I got to tell you, since we've been doing these calls and working with it, Toph is screaming messages in my ear.
Mm.
It is absolutely talking to me.
Oh, wow.
It's big and bold and loud. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Wait till you get this reading I have here. I'm doing the elemental power spread.
All right. The first one, Yod Fire, is what?
Knight of Wands.
Did you say the Knight of Wands?
Yes.
Okay.
The Knight of Torches, the Knight of Staves, whatever you want to call it, but it's the Knight of Wands here. Fire of fire. It's basically, it's in the fire position.
Yeah.
And in the Toph deck, it's as if it were the king in the Rider-Waite
suit.
You have to be aware of that.
Wow. Rulership.
And
Rulership of fire. Oh, wow.
Master number, yeah.
The physicality,
okay.
But it's also the area of physicality. It's that the imagination, that the immateria is a physical realm.
But also most mediated by being human. The night represents the active aspect of being human.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Toph deck, the knight is the king, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In a sense, yeah. The consort of the queen. Yeah.
He's the higher of the court.
Now, the next one in the first hay is...
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Is the Seven of Swords, futility.
Amazing.
In other words, don't knock on its door. It will come looking for you when it's ready for you.
You know, what's so interesting, I mean, I'm taking his words here, but I always think of the Seven of Swords as either you're pinning yourself down or you're going to release yourself from the bondage. You know what I'm saying? It's a double-edged type of thing.
Well, the swords are always double-edged.
Yeah.
So in thinking in the spirit of what you just said, which I find very interesting, so I think that's a great insight for the Seven of Swords, we either release ourselves from our current reality to walk into immateria.
Yeah, there has to be a release, an emotional release, I think, because it's in the area of water and in the emotion, the element of water and emotions. So think of it that way.
Cunning, naivety.
Mm-hmm.
I am looking at the Crowley Tarot by Akron and Hacho Banza, of two magicians from German magicians.
Mm-hmm.
Did a really nice
mm-hmm.
book on this 12th Tarot.
Yeah, they did a beautiful job.
Are we pulling cards ourselves, or what are we doing here?
If you want to, but this is a general reading.
Yeah, we can't. If we all pull cards, we'd be on the phone for the next 5 hours. So let's just do one reading. And what's air?
Air is air. Valor. Seven of Wands.
Seven of Wands.
Yeah.
Another seven and another wand. That's great.
Right.
Wow. Okay. The glory of imagination. Wow.
Seven of Wands is the glory of imagination.
I mean, that's what came to mind. Okay, I'm using my imagination. I'm immaterial right now.
I thought that was a little bit.
I have one foot in immaterial, one foot in.
Much appreciated, though.
I'm doing my shtick. I got one foot here and one foot there.
Let
me read to you a couple of things in the,
from
the book. It says, Seven of Wands, the flame of boldness, the goal, resistance against the external world.
That makes sense.
And then light is bravery, courage, fighting spirit. Shadow is indecisiveness and ignorance. And the quality is a heroic dedication of personality.
What?
So, which are probably all things that one needs to negotiate effectively the imagination.
Yeah, definitely.
Even looking at these things superficially.
That's very Promethean, too.
Yeah.
When you think of it.
Yeah, it is.
Between the Knight of Wands and the Seven of Wands, then in the manifestation area, the final he, it's the Six of Wands. Another one.
I'm sure you shuffled us.
I did. I mean, I've been shuffling, yes. Six of Wands, victory. Wow. What a glorious reading. Wait till you hear what the other two cards are. I have the benefit of that. Maybe, I'm wondering if we should not put a JPEG of this on the... I could give Paul a JPEG. I could scan it.
That would be fine.
With the question, I think that'll be fun, right?
Yeah, it'll be fun to have it, to have a visual of it. Sure.
Okay. Victory.
And then above, the sixth card above.
Wait, first we got to do motivation.
Oh, motivation.
Which is the fifth card. Okay, the hidden aspect, the Fool.
Uh-huh.
Would you believe
the
that?
The hidden aspect is
that
the Fool?
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, is
right.
See, the thing is, you could write a book on this spread.
On this spread, it's fantastic. Look at this. And the outcome, the future outcome, is the Magus.
Okay, which one?
That's a good point, because I'm using the three-card deck, the three-card Magus.
I am, too.
I'm not using the three. I don't have the three cards.
Oh, no, you're using. Okay,
I'm using the original.
It's the one with the.
It's the one that has the. He's very Caduceus looking.
Yes, he's gold, and he's got. Looks like he's juggling, maybe.
Yes.
That's
the one.
Yeah.
Well, this is again. We have a lot of alpha omega symbolism, and if you look at our past readings too. You'll see that we have extremes, and here we have the great extreme between the Fool and the Magus, right?
Which
But what are the missing elements?
Oh, everything.
No. The missing element in this whole is cups. Mm-hmm. The element of
earth
cups.
Earth and water is missing.
Huh? Earth and water are missing.
Yeah.
Some ways I would think for immaterial to work you'd need the water, but obviously
maybe not. Maybe
not according to this.
Step into it. You need to fan the flame. That's all you need to do.
Well, it sounds like we're at the beginning. Perhaps earth and water will come later.
Yeah.
We
didn't ask how to manifest what we find there, which to me would indicate there.
Well, manifestation would be the magician.
Well, yeah, but it's more the act of manifesting than the actual manifestation itself, don't you think?
Don't forget, with both magician and fool, we could be fooling ourselves, too.
Yeah.
And being tricked. I mean,
well,
being foolish.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean,
well, that would be an extension, that there's another way of doing this, which I did not cover in my elemental power spread, which would be three additional cards, in which we can pull if we want to. What do you think, Paul? To find out how we...
Well, you know, the thing is that we've got... You know, as far as official time goes, we still have 30 minutes. I think we have more than enough to discuss here and what this is. But again, you know, you can think about this stuff otherwise. So we could do it. What are the other? What are the names of the other three positions?
Oh wow! I just
I'm pulling.
I'm pulling the cards. Okay. Wait. Hold it. I'm going crazy here. Literally, this is wow.
We've lost her to the immateria.
Yes, we're lost. I'm lost in the immateria, and the last three cards. I have to go back to my book here. Okay, last three cards. Are card 7, okay, 8, and 9.
Right, and what's 7?
The Arc of Influence. This is the Arc of Influence. 7 and 9 explain the foundation energies of card 6. Okay, 7, card 7 is the Wheel of Fortune.
Oh.
Card 8 is the Moon.
Oh, boy.
Ooh.
And card 9 is Princess of Discs.
Ah, so really between Moon and Princess of Discs, beautiful card. I love that card in the top tarot. We have our water and our earth.
Mm-hmm.
So the 7, 8, 9 are themselves the Arc of Influence that deal, that are a sort of pathway for the Magus for card 6. Is that right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so all right, I just want to make that kind of clear.
You know, I know that purists say only 78 cards, but I do have to say, Suzanne Wagner really opened up my eyes to the possibility of using the, in the top row, of using the three Magus cards.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at her stuff, she considers each one a different kind of Magus. The one with the lemon scot at the top of the head, if you see the surrounding dark image around it, it's a bear. She calls that the bear sleeper Magus. And then we have the trickster Magus, the one with the monkey at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of the Cali kind of arm spread and leg movements. And then we have the Magus that pretty much... is used by everybody.
And you have to...
You use all three at the same time as well?
Me?
Yeah.
No. I don't have the extended deck.
Yes, I do use all three.
I do too.
The,
that's part of the charm of the Toss Tarot for
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
The
unfortunately, it's only in the medium-sized deck.
Yeah.
I would have loved it in the larger, but not easy.
Here we have, you have to read the Magus and the Moon together. Because that's important in the Arc of Influence.
Okay, so the...
Six
and eight are read together. Okay.
Paul, we have our four faces in the four sphinx of the chariot in the top tarot, in the top rendition.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were speaking of the four faces?
Yeah.
We have it here.
But it also speaks of that the moon and what the things that we fear about the moon, whatever the moon card represents to you.
Uh-huh.
It could be, I mean, in the sacred rose, it's almost like a psychosis area where you have to really tread very lightly. So there is the doorway. This is, and in the Toss deck, it actually looks like a doorway into the immateria, the moon card.
Yeah. It looks like a path, yes.
It's also a very sexual card.
It is very, very, very sexual, I agree.
And, I think...
Which card are you talking about now?
The moon.
And
as if it's giving birth or has the potential to
Right, it looks
birth.
Like yonis and ligaments. But also Anubis here. Anubis, the jackal-headed god of the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't... You have to watch out in the immateria not to get trapped in the underworld.
And they each carry keys.
Yes, and basically they're guardians. There is you have to pass through the guardian.
And they have...
Which always asks the question, why are you here? You have to ask the question. You have to answer, rather. And the best thing is to do some reflection before you even go into...
Uh-huh.
Why you want to even go there?
one could say that the substance of desire is imagination.
Mm.
In as much as desire and fire element is so predominant in our initial emphasis here, you know, there is so much fire and air. And in some ways, fire is its own sort of on its own feeding frenzy.
Yes.
That has being suspended between nothing and something. We're almost talking about like the Big Bang.
Mm.
So that was Faust's idea. He had a cosmological idea. He thought that the way God made the world was to imagine it. It's not an original idea, but so to the degree that our being in the image of God then was being able to imagine, which is, William Blake had the same idea, so this is, and definitely is simpatico. And then to have the wheel come up, which, represents the mechanical end of the... in other words, you could say, this is the way the world works. In other words, it works on this change in chance aspect of things. Things are always moving, and in this change, there's a chance that takes place, which also shows a basic kind of patterning.
And if you remember, Paul, in Meditations on the Tarot, Tomberg went at great lengths to criticize Dostoevsky's The Possessed, I think it was. His book, The Possessed.
Yeah.
Because he gave away the secrets, so to speak, that should have remained unspoken. And he unleashed them in his own, to use the Tomberg way, unleashed these concepts into the world, and it was not for the betterment.
Maybe we should read that again, The Possessed.
And his take, I've always found Dostoevsky very hard, I have to say. I've read The Brothers Karamazov, and I tried The Possessed. I couldn't get into it.
I had an elective minor in Russian literature. Me and Walt Amberstone, and we took up Russian literature as an elective. So we had to get through it no matter what.
Well, you had help, too.
Yeah, I had a professor.
When you do Dostoevsky,
mm-hmm.
to have a good mentor. At any rate, that he gave substance to imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that, I mean, this is not all that big a secret if you're familiar with Orthodox theology.
Right.
and Russian theology, which, you know, and the whole Orthodox tradition, Greek and Russian and Coptic, definitely does have a very profound orientation towards the imagination in that sense. What's really interesting is if we look at the Princess of Discs, because
mm-hmm.
here all of a sudden are one of our missing elements
mm-hmm.
Occurs at the end of the arc for the Magus, and it's you know, again, following some of the suggestions in the Crawley Tarot book, as for instinct, search for emotional security. And the goal is physical union, pregnancy, and birth.
Mm.
So you can see at the very end of this process, there is this sort of urge for manifestation. Actually, I don't think we actually manifest yet. You know, this is sort of like we're on the verge of the Big Bang here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're suspended between the Fool and the Magnus. And then we're talking about the Magnus's path, which would be the path of the pretense of existence, where the Fool knows nothing ever has existed. We would have this possibility of... And also, then the shadow is hedonism, indolence, and the quality is renewal, growth, and motherhood, productive or creative, the goddess Mother Earth. So you have this profound, and if you also look back, if you look also at the idea of the moon, which is sort of a vulva-like, you have emerging from that is the goddess. So it's definitely a sort of Demeter, Persephone, mother daughter emergence type of thing.
I
was going to ask Rachel a little bit more about Alan Moorhead's relationship to Otto. Because he seems to criticize the temple a great deal.
Relationship to what?
Otto.
Temple of Oriantis.
Right.
The temple that he's criticizing, okay, you know, is a specific characterization he creates.
Right.
And it seems to be of pious, moralistic people.
Okay.
So it certainly wouldn't be anything of Alistair Crowley's.
Okay.
Because if you read further ahead, you know, when he has the temple appear, they're very Victorian. So my guess is it might be the Golden Dawn if it's any particular group in mind.
Mm.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah. A bunch of stuffy theosophists.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I never that. Never.
You all had the good grace to die by now, huh?
Yeah, but it definitely wouldn't be the OTO because, of course, the OTO is not like the characterization he gives of the temple. Well, maybe it is. I mean, my elders assume the OTO is more like Crowley, which would be kind of, you know, wild and freewheeling.
Right.
Now, I love the Princess of Discs showing that she's grounding the energy.
Yeah.
You
know, that she's like, okay, got it. There's my magic. There's the magic wand, and it's going back into the earth. You know?
Johanna, what was the spot in the reading where the moon appeared?
Sorry, Rachel, I didn't understand.
Johanna drew the moon in one of the cards.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what position the reading was.
Oh, that's in the eight. That's in the Arc of Influence. It's really a triangle formation. It's directly on top of the Magus.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think this is a
wonderful. As a triangle, Johanna,
mm-hmm.
which one is on top?
The moon.
Yeah.
On top. Okay.
The moon would be on in the and which one would be on the left?
Okay.
The 7?
It would be Wheel of Fortune.
The wheel. Uh-huh.
And
okay,
then
that would be on the right, right?
So Hannah, could you send us the spread?
I'll send you the spread. I'll send
that we could all have it and we could put the cards out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're looking at it.
I've been writing this down. It'll be in.
I'll send it first to Paul.
Make a comment about the moon?
Yes, go ahead.
The moon is related to Yesod, which is the realm of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Not the moon car, which of course is a connecting line, but the moon itself is Yesod,
mm-hmm.
and it's the place of imagination.
Yes.
So, in a sense, we could identify it with the immateria, except it's not, because it's above the magician. In the Tree of Life part of Prometheus, he makes it very clear that the immateria is part of Earth. It's not actually part of the higher realms at all.
Right.
So the immateria, he calls it like the attic, where the archetypes are stored for the ancestors. Excuse me. So,
and that's much more in keeping with what I've been reading from the Zohar.
Yeah, so the journey is like through the immateria to the moon. And then the moon is the entrance to the rest of the tree. In the Golden Dawn tree, which of course Crowley followed, there are three ways to get to the rest of the tree from Malkuth, from the earth. And that's, going up through Yesod, or going to Hod, or going to Netzach.
Right.
But in the Lurianic Kabbalah, there's only one way, and that's through the moon.
Mm.
Which ends up making the tree of life look more like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Because if
mm-hmm.
you have only one line going up from the bottom up to Yesod, and everything else kind of flowers above that, looks more like a tree.
In other words, Malkuth is the roots or the trunk.
The version looks nothing like a tree to me, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's a geometric diagram. But as soon as you take out those two sidelines, it looks more like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that there's only one way in and out.
Mm-hmm.
That's through the moon.
Right.
So the moon is that gateway, as someone commented. The moon is the gateway to the spirit realms, and the gateway and the sort of funnel through which the spirit realm comes down into us. And then the way, Alan Moore, the way that it does that is through the immateria. So in other words, so the energy, the pure energy of the tree, kind of gathers at the moon in a sense, and the respective half-light, and then it's channeled into the immateria, and from the immateria to the physical.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa. We travel through the immateria to get to the moon, to get to the rest of the tree.
And so, that is such a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous way to read the moon, that card. I mean, it expands it tremendously.
Especially in this position,
Yes.
Where it's above the magician, in the trend. So, you look up the middle line of the tree, it's very clear. It goes from Earth to the moon to the sun, to the crown.
Mm.
And that's like the straight line up to, enlightenment.
Right.
From the physicality. But again, you have to go through the moon. You can't bypass it.
May I...
In one sense, you have to face your fears to get there.
Yeah, if the moon is fear, you have to face your fear. Yeah. I think the moon is much more than fear, though.
I do, too. But I mean, that's an aspect of it.
Moonlight was, considered often the substance of imagination, because you can see so many things when, if in the full moon in the forest or wherever you are.
Right.
That's when, the astral world were dancing and playing. That's why they would always say that you go crazy during full moons, is because in some ways the full moon makes manifest the will of the wisps that are running around on the edge of our imagination and our sight, and we can see.
Well, what's so interesting here too is that the body itself, our physical bodies, is made up mostly of water, and we are affected by the moon and its pull, just as the ocean is.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our ebbing and our tides and so on and so forth. And any woman, menstruating woman, will tell you how affected, one is by the moon cycles. And our cycles are, according to the moon, and babies are born in 9 months, more or less. And yada, yada, yada. So, I really feel that that Rachel, I would love to hear more about what you have to say about the moon card.
Yeah, it's not just the moon card, it's the moon place on the tree, I'm thinking.
The moon card, of course,
the Golden Dawn, is not that place, it's not Yesod.
Right.
The connecting line.
Right.
But I would tend to see it more, though, as a representation of the moon itself rather than of a line.
Okay.
The moon to me is the source of dreams and myths and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the energy that comes from. It's interesting that in lots of mythological views, the moon is older than the sun.
Yes, yes, you're right.
And I guess that comes from looking at the sky. The moon looks worn out. Before you know that.
Well, man.
Totally different substance, you know. Yeah. But like, you know, among the Greeks, for instance, you know, Artemis is born first, and then she helps her mother deliver Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
So the moon comes first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, because the moon is our more primitive state. It's the back of the brain, Kabbalistically. So it's like a deeper place in us, or the place that's more ambiguous and more complicated.
I had a very interesting occurrence with the two figures of Anubis at one time. It was when I was doing my magical studies, and it was, astral, immateria, whatever you want to call it. It was a very vivid, extremely vivid dream, okay? And they were positioned in a similar way in as a Thoth card. And the gates, they were making an infinity sign, and the gates would close and then open.
That's beautiful.
And it was the total movement. And then they said, "What is the password?" And I said, "A password that was given to me." And they opened. And I passed right through. And it was, I'm getting the chills as I'm saying this, because...
And what's so interesting is that of all the moon, I mean, the Thoth Tarot has always been a pretty scary tarot for me, but its moon card, to me, is so much more gentle.
It's not that gentle, trust me.
No,
if you really go in, if you...
You know, I can only speak for myself, Johanna. I'm not talking about... its esoteric or its magical significance as per Crowley or Odo or anything else. I'm just talking about the visual. To me, it's less scary than the Rider-Waite-Smith, for instance.
Which
ironic.
From the Marseille, you know.
Or the Marseille, right.
Yeah, the Rider-Waite-Smith comes from the Marseille.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because of the...
the thing about the two Anubises, it certainly strikes me, it's sort of similar to the Ark of the Covenant. Which had the two cherubim, the great angel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think it's cherubim. The cherubim was seraphim, I forget which was. But, you know, and the tradition was...
The cherubim, I say cherubim, but you're absolutely right, cherubim.
Cherubim, yeah. Cherubim, which is really good. So the tradition was that when Israel was in harmony with God, then the two of them were facing each other in some saying sexual congress, you know, to use the old expression. And then when Israel fell out of harmony with God, they turned away from each other.
Really? That is very
interesting. That has been Patai and Graves, the Hebrew goddess.
Yeah, a lot of places. In fact, there's a story, I don't know how historically, you know, accurate it is, but there's a story that when the Romans sacked the temple, they found these two statues posed as if having sex.
Mm-hmm.
And they took them through the streets and said to the Judeans, you know, you see what your great secret is? It's pornography.
God.
Your great God is pornographic. And
the Romans said that?
That's always the secret. There was a wonderful work done by two women archaeologists who were studying the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they went in there and explored the explicit sexual symbolism and the rites that were around the in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And and they went so far as to postulate baptismal rites that use menstrual blood. But unfortunately, as interesting as this book was, no one ever reviewed it. I mean, they had serious credentials, but you know, because they weren't towing the party line of religious orthodoxy, even though their writings were well grounded in the language and the things, they were so outside of what was acceptable by orthodoxy that their works were ignored.
What a smelly baptism.
It's actually worse than being suppressed. Being ignored is just terrible, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's not so ignored, because that's like part of the whole, what Elaine Pagels would say, they don't even want to use the word Gnostic anymore because it has such a pejorative term in terms of scholarship.
The idea of Gnosticism, as it was invented by scholars in the 18th and 19th century, has they know so much more about what they call Gnosticism now.
Right.
That they see that the term is putting too many apples and oranges and bananas together.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So it makes better sense to talk about them in less global terms.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basis of the understanding why they're backing away from the term Gnosticism. Anyway, most people that I know of who say they are Gnostics, you have to really get down clear, because in the technical view of what a Gnostic is, again, going by the scholarship, not by what people think, what people say they're doing, is that you're a radical dualist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas, now the way I use the term Gnosis, and I think it's also the way Tomberg used Gnosis,
is
a technical term for unitive knowledge.
Exactly.
And that's almost radically the opposite.
Yeah, it's
complicated, Paul, because you have, like, you know, the same word as God in the Tree of Life.
Right.
Knowledge.
Which we'll be getting to in Prometheus.
Yeah, which is great. God is a really fabulous chapter. The thing is that, so the one, it definitely means that direct experience of God, you know.
Right.
But there's a whole doctrine around it, which is, you know, Kabbalistic as well as Greek Gnostic, which is that, you know, that you have to shun the body. You have to get rid of the body to have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
You have to free yourself from this awful, gross, disgusting, you know, trapped prison of a body. Which was devised by people.
I thought that there were two roads. One was that road, the road you described, and the other was utter hedonism.
Well, but if we look at the reading that we just got, if we look at the card
mm-hmm,
that we drew
mm-hmm.
for today, in some ways, what you just said, Rachel, about not having a body, when it says, what is the immaterial and what is our relationship to it, it's
mm-hmm.
almost telling us that to be fully present to this imagination, being suspended between the magus and the fool, that what comes up in that, to the degree that we have a path, which is the last three cards that we're looking at this time, we have the moon, and we also we have eventual manifestation in the princess of discs.
Mm-hmm.
What's almost saying that all of this is pre-existent. It's existence before there's stuff. And we only get to the possibility of stuff in the realm of the moon, through the moon, through that path of the wheel, the moon, and the princess of discs. It's an interesting. It's an interesting symbolic way of sort of saying the way that we have to not. Things. And by the way, it's a pretty common idea in Yoga Vashishta, which is a book of Indian book of fairy tales, metaphysical fairy tales. It's primary. It's which is always talking about how the world's created. It basically says that the sage knows that the world has never existed. In other words, there's no real creation. There's no real. Destruction. They're actually those sages, you know, thoroughly rooted in the emptiness of everything. Though I don't think they put it quite like that. It sounds a little too Buddhistic, but you know, this acosm. And actually, the Stoics were acosmic, according to a professor of mine. That one of the part of the way they maintain their view of equanimity. You know, apatheia, was at its root was connected knowing that nothing in this world truly exists. Nothing, that our self doesn't exist, that the world doesn't exist, nothing exists. And again, it's an acosmic view of things, almost to the point of being anti-metaphysical. By the way, does everybody know about the Buddha story that's likely to be on tonight on the PBS station, 9 o'clock?
Is it going to be any good, do you think?
I have no idea.
Who's presenting it?
Some PBS, I don't know. It's probably going to be
Moyers?
A biography of the Buddha, huh?
Bill Moyers?
I don't know.
It's like a theatrical kind of production.
Yeah.
Oh, a theatrical thing.
Yeah.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if it's, you know, sort of a story of the Buddha, you know, and how he lives in, you know, magnificence and doesn't understand the nature of the world and then discovers the world and is completely appalled by it and walks away from his luxuries to understand the nature of the world. Boy, I found that. It's an archetypal tale if there ever was one.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, that's Bob Place's Buddha Tarot and his book, The Buddha Companion.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I haven't looked at it in a while.
Is anyone watching Supernatural? Am I the only Supernatural person?
I've watched it on occasion, but not much.
I don't watch it with any regular.
Oh,
yeah.
They're getting into some good stuff now. they have actually said that the God has turned his back on mankind. They got the message. And the Demiurge. They're making it now a Gnostic tale of the Demiurge. Ambivalent. Hey, listen, you people work it out for yourself. And I had this whole discussion. And then I had this whole discussion with my niece, Andrea, who is into Supernatural. And I says, well, if they're going that route, she says, well, how come all the ladies die? You know, none of the ladies live. I said, because we have to have the manifestation of Sophia. So if they're following the Demiurge story, then we have to have Sophia come in, and that will be the salvation.
I started to watch it at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it just seems so male. It's all about these super.
Yeah, it's all male and everything. Now,
that's another reason why the woman would die. It's only about the men.
Right, exactly. You cannot have too many women.
Women, you know?
Women create problems.
That's an archetypal tale of their
own. Right, exactly. And I'm watching this because I'm saying, where are we going with these angels and everything? I love the, how they do the angels as the mafia, you know? Type of thing going
like,
on.
Like Prometheus.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we have a. So I'm keeping up with it. I've also liked the humor of you know, they really do put a lot of humor in all their angst and problems. So now we finally got to a core of a situation, and if you could pick it up this season. You don't have to have any other seasons. I'll be honest with you. This is now, we're getting to the meat of everything.
Getting to the meat, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'll TiVo it. I'll put it on my TiVo list.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We're about ready to wrap up for today. I have a feeling that that it might make sense for people, if they have the time or the inclination, to play around with this with the spread that we did. I think it's got
a lot of potential.
Yes. I want to make sure that I have the question correct only when I write it down. What is the immateria? That's cards 1-6. Then what is our relationship to it and how do we access it? Cards 7-9.
All right, that's good to know. I'll add that to the question.
Yeah.
And you'll send us the spread? Like,
I'll send you the spread. I have to do some scanning over here.
Yeah, she'll scan it. I've got it written down in a way that's at least diagrammatically in its schema.
And this is the spread that's in the back of your book on your Sacred Rose Tarot.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. It's in the Guide to the Sacred Rose Tarot. That's what we're using. and for the analysis.
Okay.
Molto bene.
Yep.
So, thanks, folks, and
the next chapter is, I have it bookmarked here.
No Man's Land.
Yeah.
Okay.
Margaret.
Oh, by the way, Rachel, if you're going to be at the Reader Studio, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to be making available as one of those raffle gifts that they give away during the thing, an unopened collector's issue of the Promethea action figures. Would you be willing to, when it's time to explain what that gift is, that you can go up and give a little testimony about how you love yours and play with it regularly?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Great, I appreciate it. All right.
Regularly, that's great.
Well, I'll be at the banquet. So if
by the way, folks, it's you can still pick them up pretty cheap on eBay, but then they're out of. They're out of production, so once they're gone forever.
Mm. Oh, by the way, I did want to let everybody know, The World as Imagination, I bought it on Amazon.
Fantastic.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. I'll have to look it up. It was the one volume of Douglas's writings that I was never able to... I got it out of interlibrary loan once. It's a big fat book, but I was never able to get it.
Well, let me look in the beginning. It is reprinted 2010, so it's evidently just gone back.
Oh,
to reprint.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, you know, idealism has made a comeback, folks.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's The World of Imagination.
Uh-huh. And it's by...
The World is Imagination.
The World as. No, the World as Imagination. And...